Before we begin, Charlotte, North Carolina, and Fort Wayne, Indiana, I see you both out there, and I appreciate your support and continued listening. Now, on to the show. Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're going to talk about what I'm reading about, and we are going to cover a few quick articles, probably only three of them in this episode, including the new COVID-19 trial that you need to know about, and I'll give you my two cents. So with that, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Question Medicine 2020. Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing. Let's kick this off. And we are going to start with COVID-19. Yes, oh yes. I covered a bunch of articles about COVID-19. And I told you that if there was anything new that came out, anything that I thought you should actually know about in this garbage of literature that we call COVID-19 that was unrandomized, uncontrolled, unplaceboed, unsample sized, un-everything except for the drug companies trying to make an extra buck when you really read through the nuts, butts, and guts of the articles, then I would tell you, the listener, what you should know about. And you should know about this, the recovery trial. This is pre-print at this point. It is only came out online June 22nd. I'm recording this on June 24th. That means it has not been peer-reviewed. Maybe during the peer review process, they will find something that I have not found now, because they have more information. When you're doing a peer review, you can ask more questions and get more of the background information if you really want it. So take that with a grain of salt, but I think you should know about it, because I think this is game-changing. As in, you should listen to this today on June 24th, and if you're not already doing it, you should probably do it with the small caveats that I'm going to mention in this podcast. Now, the name of the article is titled Effect of Dexamethasone in Hospitalized Patients with COVID-19, a Preliminary Report. This is the recovery trial. It's a randomized controlled trial, open label, that compared 6 milligrams of dexamethasone given once a day, either oral or IV, for up to 10 days versus just usual care alone. They looked at just over 2,000 patients that were going to receive dexamethasone, and then just over 4,000 patients that were receiving usual care, and that's because they randomized patients in a 1-to-2 fashion. The primary outcome was 28-day mortality. Bravo to you, my friends. Bravo to you, because 28-day mortality is something I care about. It's something my patients care about. It's something everyone cares about, and they didn't just look at, well, we were going to look at how much oxygen they were using. No, that's a garbage endpoint. Way to pick something that sticks, something that we can hang our hat on. In the end, 21% of the patients allocated to dexamethasone versus 24% of the patients randomized to usual care died within 28 days. That's an absolute difference of 3% for individuals dying at 28 days if you did not get dexamethasone. That in and of itself is huge. If you're just saying, oh my goodness, look at this, 3% absolute benefit, that's a number needed to treat of around 33 for death. For death. We don't really have a lot of drugs that do death, right? We have a lot of drugs that do secondary prevention for a myocardial infarction, number needed to treat of around 60, aspirin, and we would never think twice about it. This is death at 28 days. We should probably not think twice about that. But one of the most interesting facts, statistics, graphs in this paper was the breakdown, the subgroup analysis of using the dexamethasone. Now, normally I will tell you subgroup analysis are absolutely nothing. They're just completely hypothesis generating. You shouldn't use them for anything, because you just shouldn't use them for anything. Except listen to the subgroup analysis here. On the individuals who were not on any oxygen, dexamethasone did not reduce all-cause mortality, 17% versus 13%. The 13% was the usual care. The 17% was the dexamethasone. Now, that did not meet statistical significance because the confidence interval crossed 1, but just barely. And I would say if you really looked at it with a real critical eye, you would say almost, with that 4% difference there, that potentially dexamethasone actually caused more harm, more death in the first 28 days than giving it. So if we gave it, there was more harm in individuals than if we did not give it. So what about the patients who were receiving oxygen, nasal cannula, a CPAP, some other oxygen, not intubated, but just some sort of oxygen? Well, in that cohort, dexamethasone, 21.5%, usual care, 25% death rate at 28 days, which makes a number needed to treat of right about 30 again. That's pretty good. That we can hang our hat on. That's really beneficial. And if you were intubated, 6 milligrams of dexamethasone every day, one time, for 10 up to 10 days was a showstopper. A number needed to treat of right about 9 for mortality at 28 days. That is huge. So it seems the sicker you are, then, you know, if you're on no oxygen, there's no benefit. If you're on some oxygen, there's benefit. And if you're intubated and requiring a lot more oxygen, well, then there's a huge benefit. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. Now, when I first read this, I will tell you, I had my own last case bias. My last cases that I've read of any papers really for COVID-19 have been absolutely terrible. And it has been so hard to not seep in of, well, every other paper I read was terrible. This paper is obviously going to be terrible. The last case bias. It's like the person that comes in with a hurt leg and then you find out later, oh my goodness, they're having a heart attack. Does that mean all people that come in with a hurt leg are having a heart attack? No, absolutely not. And you can't go forward from then on out and say, oh, look at this. I'm going to treat all people from now on with a hurt leg. I'm going to order troponins on them. That would be absolutely ludicrous, insane, and just really chaotic, idiotic. I don't agree with that sort of practice. So I had to throw out my own individual last case bias. And if you go to read this study, I would encourage you to do the same. Now, it was an open label trial. Obviously, this is not ideal, but I do believe that doctors are good people. And what I mean by that is open label, meaning the doctors knew what you were getting. Were the doctors maybe trying harder if they knew you were getting dexamethasone in order to keep you alive? Or they maybe were not trying as hard on the people that were not getting dexamethasone? I don't think so. I don't think that's really a feasible thing. Would it be possible that if you were getting dexamethasone, that you were then getting some other drug, you know, maybe I'm using this as an example, I don't know, hydrochloroquine or something like that, that then worked synergistically with the dexamethasone to actually show the benefit, where those individuals who were not getting the dexamethasone didn't have that synergistic effect? That's possible. It's going to be hard to say. And looking at the authors and the trials and the details of how they ran their study, I also don't think that's the case. But, you know, again, it's totally possible. And we don't have a list of every patient, all 6,000 patients, all 6,000 patients' medications that they were getting while in the hospital. So that is really impossible to tell. And finally, my only other major critique on this study is that you were enrolled in the study if you had confirmed PCR, confirmed COVID, or you had clinically expected COVID, clinically diagnosed COVID. Those are not quite the same thing. And now my problem is that they're not the same thing. So can you say that they're the same thing? But my other problem or issue is that we know this test is terrible. The test for COVID-19 is awful. I think almost everyone who's seen enough of these patients has seen someone go negative, negative, positive, negative, 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 positive, negative, 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 negative. You get the idea. It goes on and on and on forever. And then how many swabs do you do till you realize, well, those two positives were clearly just false positives? I mean, if you have one man have a positive pregnancy test, how many more times do you have to test them before you realize, that was just a false positive on a pregnancy test on a man? Obviously, the test doesn't have 100% accuracy, and we know that. And anyone who says otherwise, they just haven't treated or tested enough patients. Now, the good news in this trial, as I mentioned earlier, is that it seemed to be as you got sicker, the more you benefited from dexamethasone. Almost every ventilated patient met criteria for acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, and almost every patient that was enrolled would have met the criteria for ARDS in almost every trial that's been performed of recent. I mean, these people were sick individuals, and this end outcome, this number needed to treat of around 9, that's very similar to other benefits that we have seen in intensive care medicine that are now standard of care in intensive care medicine. Numbers like 8% benefit with a low tidal volume or 16% benefit that we saw with proning. It is totally possible that these numbers are absolutely real. It's totally possible. And what if these numbers are not real? What if the number needed to treat of 9 is actually not 9 at 28 days? What if in real world population in your ICU, what if that number needed to treat is, 15, 20? What if it's 3 times worse than a trial and it's all the way up to 27? Well, my answer is 1, who cares? And 2, who cares? The reason being is that it's dexamethasone. It's cheap. It's 6 milligrams for 10 days. We've given a whole lot more steroids to people for a lot less things, I promise you, and for no real clinical evidence-based reason, and certainly not a mortality-based reason. And there's a lot of people out there that will say, well, dexamethasone, it has very little mineral corticoid activity, and the mineral corticoids are the things that they're the bad actions, and this is a lot of glucocorticoid activity, which is causing this benefit and decreased inflammation and blah, blah. I don't know. I'll tell you, that's for the ivory towers. That's for the birds. That's not for me. But so far in COVID, we've had people giving everything from TPA, TPN, just made up combinations of drugs that they've gotten off trials that have no control arm, no standardized power, no calculations to them, just random publications. We've had people giving drugs that they've seen on social media, Facebook and Twitter and what have you. I mean, no evidence-based whatsoever. We now have something that is evidence-based and really good evidence-based. And even if it's not quite as evidence-based as it is in this trial, if in the real-world setting it's not as good as it was shown in this trial, it's still going to be better than what you're currently doing so far based on your social media rants or empire or what have you. So for me, this is a game changer. This is a must-do right now if someone has COVID-19, either expected or for sure confirmed diagnosed, 6 milligrams PO or IV dexamethasone once a day up to 10 days, period, end of story. And if they're not on oxygen, then I probably wouldn't use this, or at least I'm not going to be using it. But if they are on oxygen or intubated or have ARDS or whatever it may be, this is it. Boom, there you go. That is the end of it. And with that, let's get on to a different article, something that might be a little bit more entertaining. Oh my goodness, we have already flown. We have flown through so much of this podcast. I just get on the rants and I don't know when to stop. So with that, let's just hurry into the next article, shall we? It is titled, Comparison of Cardiovascular and Safety Outcomes of Chlorothalidone versus Hydrochlorothiazide to Treat Hypertension. This is in JAMA Internal Medicine earlier this year. And the objective of the study was to compare the effectiveness and safety of chlorothalidone and hydrochlorothiazide for first-time antihypertensive drug users. They use a large database cohort to look at individuals that were taking first-time antihypertensive medications for at least a year. This was a huge cohort, as I mentioned, almost 750,000 people, 730,000 people in this trial from 2001 to 2019. And this was a retrospectoscope looking to see the primary outcomes of comparing chlorothalidone versus hydrochlorothiazide. What was the difference in acute myocardial infarction, hospitalization for heart failure, ischemic or hemorrhagic stroke, and a composite cardiovascular outcome that included all three of those and sudden cardiac death. And then they looked at 51, yes, 51 safety outcomes. If you're counting along at home, that is a total of 55 different outcomes that they were looking at, which if just done in and of itself, you would say to yourself, well, that is way too many outcomes. You see, I know, Andrew, I know from listening to Question Medicine that a p-value of 0.05 means that at least one out of every 20 things that you look at are going to be quote-unquote false positives, because that's what a p-value of 0.05 means. So if you're looking at 55 different outcomes, we can almost safely say that at least 3 outcomes are going to be quote-unquote false positives. except for they did something really cool that I will explain here shortly, but I will quote it in the article. To address multiplicity concerns, we indicate which estimates remain statistically significant after a Bonferroni correction for 55 hypotheses. In the end, the results, the bottom line, the thing that you need to take home if you're not going to listen to anything else I'm going to say is that there was no significant difference. Yes, no significant difference was found in the association for the risk of myocardial infarction, hospitalized heart failure, or stroke. However, chlorothalidone was associated with a significantly higher risk of hypokalemia, hyponatremia, acute renal failure, chronic kidney disease, and type 2 diabetes mellitus. Now, as I stated, there was no difference in cardiovascular disease events, which is a good thing. But remember, these were first-time hypertensive medication patients, meaning these patients were not the Hondas that we see in many trials. They were not the hypertensive, obese, non-compliant, diabetic, alcoholic. No. I mean, sure, they had hypertension, but this was the first hypertension medication they were getting. And maybe they had diabetes, but they would have maybe only been diabetic and obese and now finally diagnosed with hypertension. If you're only following them up for a minimum of a year and then the mean was somewhere, you know, right around 1.8 months of follow-up, I don't really expect those patients to have that many events because they're really, although they're not super healthy by any means, no one's going to argue, oh, well, I mean, these are the patients that we would expect to live a long time. No one's saying that they should live a long time. I just don't expect first-time hypertensive patients to get or to die or to have a stroke or have a heart attack within the next year and a half. That's just not something I typically would expect to see a large event rate. However, because there was over 700,000 patients that they looked at, they could have potentially found something there because there was so many people. But overall, the event rate has to be very small, just in my own interpretation and what I have seen in the data. Now, if you just read the paper and not the abstract, but you actually read the paper and you only read the results section of the paper and you didn't read the abstract and you didn't read the methods section, you would read that chlorothalidone was associated with a significantly higher risk of hypokalemia, hyponatremia, acute renal failure, chronic kidney disease, and type 2 diabetes. Chlorothalidone was also associated with an increased risk of hypomagnesemia, hyperkalemia, vomiting, syncope, gout, impotence, anaphylactoid reaction, and associated with a decreased risk of anemia, depression, dementia, and anxiety. Whew, that's a lot, but that's not what they say in the abstract. In the abstract, they only mention hypokalemia, hyponatremia, acute kidney failure, chronic kidney disease, and diabetes mellitus. And you might say to yourself, well, Andrew, why didn't they mention the rest of those things? Why didn't they mention those other 8 bad outcomes that you just told me about? And that's because they did the Bonferroni calculation. And this, my friends, is really cool. This is where we're going to talk nerdy for a split second. This is where I'm going to tell you that next time if you read a trial, this is what this means when they say the Bonferroni calculation or approach. You see, we all know that if you're looking at almost 60 things, you're going to find some things that are false positives. You're going to find type 1 errors. You're going to find individuals that are male that test positive on a pregnancy test. But if multiple hypotheses are tested, the chance of observing a rare event increases. We know that. And therefore, the likelihood of incorrectly rejecting the null hypothesis increases. Meaning, we are rejecting the null. We're saying, no, there's not no difference. There's definitely a difference between hydrochlorothiazide and chlorothalidone. And look at it. And the more things we look at, the more likely we are we're going to find something. But if you do the Bonferroni approach, the calculation, then you calculate for these multiple analyses. You say, I know, I realize I'm not just looking at one thing. I'm not just looking for hypokalemia between chlorothalidone and hydrochlorothiazide. I'm looking at hypokalemia, hyperkalemia, hyponatremia, hypernatremia, anemia, leukocytosis, leukopenia, diabetes, and I'm looking for all these things. And so then you recalculate your calculation, if you will. You realize that your p-value has to be so much smaller when you're doing these multiple corrections. And that is the Bonferroni approach. It says, listen, you can go ahead and do all kinds of calculations here. You can go ahead and just, I mean, you can look at 1,000 different things if you want to, but then you have to calculate that you looked for 1,000 different things. And so no longer is a p-value of 0.05 statistically significant because you looked for 1,000 things. It has to be much smaller. And there is a whole calculation that if you really want to figure it out, you can go online and you can look at what that calculation would be. And it's not important to talk about here in the podcast, but it's important for you to know what a Bonferroni calculation or Bonferroni approach is. So if you see it when you're reading the literature, you know that's what it is. And that means that you've done a good trial because you realize, look, I've looked for way too many things here, but I'm going to correct that by calculating that I have looked for too many things and see what is still statistically significant after all of these things that I've looked into. So, after the Bonferroni calculation, chlorothalidone was still associated with a significantly higher risk of hypokalemia, hyponatremia, acute renal failure, chronic kidney disease, and type 2 diabetes mellitus. And many people will say, well, yes, yes, I understand that. But you see, chlorothalidone, it's a stronger drug. It's a more potent drug than hydrochlorothiazide. So clearly, you can't compare apples to apples, or at least not the same bushel basket of apples to the same bushel basket of apples. And the authors had already thought of this. The authors are one step ahead of you, and they say in the paper, the subgroup receiving 12.5 milligrams of chlorothalidone versus 25 milligrams of hydrochlorothiazide had a calibrated hazard ratio of 1.5, passing the Bonferroni threshold. No other outcomes passed the threshold. So they're saying, even once we calculate half a dose of chlorothalidone to a or half a milligram to 12.5 milligrams versus 25 milligrams of hydrochlorothiazide, even once we do that, and even once we do the Bonferroni correction, even then, hypokalemia is still statistically significant. We've done all these calculations. We've half the dose of chlorothalidone, and it still causes more rates of significant hypokalemia. In the end, the real thing I think that we care about are cardiovascular events. And many of us care about the surrogate marker that is blood pressure. Because remember, that's not a hard marker. Surrogate marker of blood pressure is just a surrogate marker for what we think that the event is, which is a stroke and a heart attack. It's nothing but a very glorified surrogate marker. I think we just have to control the blood pressure. It probably doesn't really matter what drugs you use out of the main ones of the calcium channel blockers, the diuretics, the thiazides, the lisinopril, the ACEs, the ARBs. It probably doesn't matter really what you use if you're following, you know, the guidelines. Just use one of them and control the blood pressure. Get the blood pressure down. Pick one, stick with it, and that's what it should be. But we should also do no harm. We should use the drugs with the fewer side effects. That is just probably a good standard rule of thumb for everything we should do. We should use drugs that have fewer side effects when possible. And so if we're using drugs that have fewer side effects that are relatively cheap, we're going to go right. And I think we can for sure say that hydrochlorothiazide has fewer side effects than chlorothalidone. So it's probably what we should be writing for, unless in your neighborhood, unless where you live, chlorothalidone is free and hydrochlorothiazide is, you know, $500, then maybe you can justify it. But if you're going to write for chlorothalidone, then you at least for sure you need to follow up with potassium rechecks. Statistically, here you have to do that, especially with this data and coming out, if you're not already doing it. So with that, let's wrap this up. And truly, in this time, 30 seconds or less, put me on the clock. Here we go. If you are taking care of a patient with COVID-19 that is requiring oxygen, either intubated or supplemental oxygen, then give them dexamethasone, 6 milligrams IV or PO. If they're not on oxygen, probably no need to give them dexamethasone. And if you are taking care of a patient with high blood pressure, then hydrochlorothiazide over chlorothalidone. Bada boom, bada bing, let's end this podcast as we've ended every podcast before it. Wait for the music. Here it comes. Here it comes. Here it comes. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.